Good morning. Welcome to The Old School, a podcast about, among other things, the American education system, but in its own way and own time, we also tap into culture, history, food, travel, what have you. And well, with this, with me on this endeavor, here, Dr. Bourgeois. Good morning, Dr. Bourgeois.
Dr. Miller. I call you Dr. Mr. Miller. You're a doctor in my book, damn it.
I'm an honorary doctor. I'm one of those people.
Absolutely. But it's good.
There's nothing more useless than an honorary doctorate. Maybe a doctorate in education. I don't know if that's
that was a cheap shot there, I feel. Complimenting you. You just let me have it. That's the best time.
Us today is theater arts teacher extraordinaire, Brian Ketchum. Good morning, Mr. Ketchum.
Morning, guys. Well, happy to be here. Excited to be here.
And so what we decided to do was this podcast today is going to be a Rangers 2024 preview show. We're going to break down the pitching staff, bullpen, look at starting lineup, try to figure out, because I'm kind of like in the mood because I just got finished watching a preview of the 2024 Motor City Kitties, the Detroit Tigers, and it left me with a question. Since I'm dealing with two people from the North, one kind of adjacent, but you, here, Dr. Bourgeois, claim Michigan as part of your CV. What is Detroit-style pizza? Because I don't know.
I thought we were talking about baseball, and that's confusing. Seems like it's almost upside down, my impression. But I should know this better. But it's not Chicago style, certainly.
Certainly.
But something's not right in the order of the toppings. And maybe, Brian, you can
help us out. I actually just bought a Detroit pizza pan, which is an old Lloyd Auto Parts metal pan, and they would sort auto parts in it, and then they started cooking in it. But the main thing I think that separates Detroit from Chicago is the sauce goes on top. Mm-hmm. And then they tend to oil the sides of this slightly angled pan, so it gets that nice, and then they put the cheese to the edge, so to get that nice crisp edge on it.
That's right.
And I've been experimenting with different doughs, trying to perfect my Detroit style pizza. Even though I prefer my sauce underneath, I love their legit style crispy crust.
Mm-hmm. Did you say legit style crispy crust?
Jets, like Jets Pizza.
Awesome.
They're,
okay, all right.
They're the only chain I know that does Detroit style around here.
Okay. I'm confused. You and I, Steve, we both have tried Chicago style pizza in the Windy City. Not really a pizza, it's more of a casserole, I think is a typical joke about Chicago style pizza. Would you say, Brian, since you are an expert, certainly among the three of us, really expert about Detroit pizza, does Detroit pizza kind of almost share qualities of the casserole like Chicago pizza? Would you say it has more legitimacy, more authenticity, or where do you fit it in?
Casserole is correct for Chicago style. It's so thick, and it's like, I feel like I'm just cutting through toppings. I feel like a Detroit style pizza, you get a nice, you know, inch and a half crust, and then you get, you know, an appropriate amount of cheese and sauce. I feel like Chicago is just like I'm swimming through the sauce. There's different cheese. There's a lot going on there. It feels almost soupy sometimes if it's not cooked right. I would put it in the casserole category closer than the pizza category.
So Brian, can you pick up a piece of Detroit pizza and actually hold it in your hand and eat it like a proper piece of pizza, or do you have to use a knife and fork?
If you cut it with a pizza slicer, you can hold it. It's not like a Neapolitan where you get the droopy tip. Right. But no, it Detroit holds its own. I don't feel like a Chicago style would hold its own without a fork.
Right. You wouldn't be able to make it through the first bite, probably.
Right.
Who says we don't answer questions here on the Old School podcast? We offer solutions insofar as we know the solutions. And so there you go. For all those who wondered, including me, that's what Detroit style pizza is and what it's not. But so one of the reasons why we have Brian Ketchum on is one is because he's a very fun guy to have on and to talk to. I had the privilege of working with him at Keller High School. But one of the things we're going to talk about today deals with kind of fine arts in general and theater arts in particular. And Brian, you actually started in the noblest of professions, that of a history teacher. And for reasons passing all understanding, you left it. For you, what was your kind of progression from going from history teacher to a very widely recognized theater teacher at Keller?
I knew I wanted to be a history teacher from eighth grade. I had a history teacher that dressed up every day in time period clothes, and he could tell stories that would leave you on the edge of your seat, right? And so I knew from then on I wanted to be a history teacher. And I took a lot of theater classes in high school, mostly because they had tools in the shop I could use and build stuff, and there was a lot of girls. That was the general logic. But then I knew I wanted to be a history teacher. I went to college to be a history teacher. I taught history for 10 years. I never played football. I played baseball, I played other sports. So I never played football. I never even learned to throw a spiral. And my first job was, we can hire you to teach history, but you have to coach. Huh. And I was able to hide the fact that I couldn't throw a spiral for about a month. And then all the other coaches figured it out, and it became this fun game to, let's play catch and try to throw the ball over here. I eventually did pick it up, but I coached for, I think, 5 years. But then I taught history, and I loved it. I loved every second of it. I even enjoyed teaching middle schoolers. I thought they were a very fun, unique group. And I really do enjoy the first half of American history a lot. And so I did that for 10 years, like I said, and I loved all of it. The transition happened when our district cut a bunch of spots, I think back in 09 or 2010. They were eliminating a coach spot. And I was like, look, I enjoy coaching, but like, I really just like to teach. So let somebody else keep their coaching spot. I don't need it. And then I just started teaching history full time, which was great. But what I learned was then I had an eighth period class, which was the last period of the day, which was typically athletics. And I got all the kids who weren't in athletics. So a lot of theater, band, choir kids. And at first, it was kind of a weird adjustment. I was like, oh, these kids just don't react the same way. They don't understand an analogy of sports or whatever. And I found them to be a challenge, but then I really enjoyed it. I found them to be a very enjoyable group of people to be around. And their quirks were a high spot of my day rather than a frustration. So
it's an interesting correlation, because we talked about it before, where Steve has suggested that, you know, the students that took German or was one of the things that made his classes more interesting, because the kiddos were a little bit different than the kiddos that took Spanish. I mean, when you make that correlation, Steve?
You could spot them coming down the hall. I mean, but, you know, in the 90s and the early 2000s, they were more on the Gothic side, or they wore black. You could tell. I used to stand outside the door with a Spanish teacher, and she played a game of guessing the German students. But yeah, you're right. The students who aren't, you know, in athletics are a little bit quirky and interesting, and there's nothing dull about them. They just kind of jump off the page.
So did theater and history ever merge at any point before you made the full transition? Did you become that teacher from teachers where Nick Nolte and Joe Beth Williams and the history teacher that always dressed up as George Washington seemingly every day? I mean, did you run that period of time, or was it a complete break?
I mean, I felt like from my first year, I tried to merge it. I mean, I would dress up a kid. I had like Ben Franklin whole get up. And I had a couple of ones, Davy Crockett, a few others. So I could dress up occasionally and mix and match stuff in. But what I liked was a lot of the hands-on stuff. So like I would go out and cut a bunch of wooden rifles. And then like we're talking about, you know, the Revolutionary Army, we take them out, or not rifle, but, you know, we cut shapes of those. Anyway, we go outside, we march them around outside just to get them going. And so I like some of that. We started incorporating some, you know, more arts and stuff of what was going on during the time period, the Civil War, like what, you know, what stuff the soldiers would be reading and interested in watching. And we'd start diving deeper into things on, you know, like almost like treasure hunts, if you will, of what, you know. And sometimes that was like, well, like one of the big ones we had, I'm rambling at this point, sorry, was like one of the kids goes, where's General Cornwallis's surrender sword? Because it was given to the Americans and then it was given back ceremonially. And then we had the kids kind of diving in deep and they're like, well, he got it back. Then he ended up here and they ended up calling the Smithsonian. They ended up calling over in England a couple of the places. And the best guess we have is it's buried with them in India. But the kids were like, you know, he would go to these type of shows. So they were trying to reach out to these other venues if they had any pictures of him, like, you know, doing some historical research based on what his hobbies were, which I thought was interesting. And like, do you have any photos of him there? Do you have a sword? And it kind of became this year-long scavenger hunt these kids got into on their own. But so trying to work in stuff like that. But then we also would do like a big treasure hunt outside where they had to like orienteer, a lot of Boy Scout type stuff. But a lot of that still ties into that theater vibe, I feel, a little bit too. So
probably just as well you went into theater. You're just going to make the rest of us look bad in the history sections.
Yeah, you never did any of that, Herr Miller.
No, I never did.
Things in flat.
Yeah, I didn't have the confidence. That's the problem.
Right. You actually brought up Nick Nolte independently, Ross. You said it was some fondness. I'm wondering if you've changed since you've retired and taken a different look at your teaching career.
No. I'm fine. There always was a time when you looked upon the teachers like Brian, mm-hmm. and you thought, one, I wish I was that confident. Two, I wish I was that creative. You know, my discussion oriented thing is basically the product of a lack of creativity. Yeah. So a lot of things that I did was trying to make up for the fact that I just didn't have that. It was not part of my bailiwick, as it were. So for some, though, who became quite well known for it, I mean, it's just, there's nothing better. But for me, I could never do that. So.
Well, why don't you keep doing your questioning here, Miller, because you're moving towards asking something in this sequence, I have a feeling.
Well, yeah, it's it comes down to, as you're marrying these two together, then theater comes up at some point. And not just theater, but a move to high school. How did that happen for you?
Yeah, I remember it vividly. Eighth grade has a STAR test, standardized testing. And I had thought that it was a waste of our time because we're losing a month and a half of the year of actually teaching to rush it in. And it was a big source of frustration. I talked to my legislators. I talked to state representatives. I went down to Austin and got an appointment even with the Speaker of the House, for the state of back in 08 or 09. Anyways, very frustrated with the process. And we had a fairly new principal, and I do enjoy her. I'm not speaking ill of her. But I remember distinctly, we redid a lot of how we taught, but we still were able to have fun and enjoy it. And I remember we had the highest scores as a school in the entire North Texas area, not just our district, not just the surrounding districts, but the highest scores. And I was like, okay, so that all worked. Like, we have great scores. They're going to be off our back. And the first meeting we had after that was, your scores are so good. We're like, thank you. Go, what are we going to do next year? And I said, I don't know. Probably the same thing we did this year that worked pretty well. Well, no, we got to do more. And I'm like, there's no more to give that doesn't take the fun out of what we're doing. And I remember distinctly, I got home and I was like, where do I get to go and teach and educate students, but be creative and have freedom of that? And I was just sitting there thinking, and I was like, why don't I do theater? Like, I don't think a good principal even knows what a good band director looks like or a theater teacher looks like, because they don't know. But they can tell. I mean, like, they don't know, they can't describe what it is, but they can tell. And so I remember I emailed our fine arts director at the district, who I'd never met. And I said, hey, I'm interested in maybe getting to theater at some point. I have no interest in doing it at the middle school level because I don't want to do that much work and do small productions in a cafetorium. If I'm going to do so, I'm going to do it big. And she was kind of like, okay, well, you know, one of our other schools might like a hand, and I'll put you in contact with them. And I joined them for the one-act process. And I finally actually got to meet our fine arts director at a conference a little bit later that year. And I said, hi, I'm Brian Ketchum. We haven't actually met. And she said, okay, good. Nice to meet you. I'm so glad you're working there. And I said, yeah, I want to be hired as one of your theater teachers. And she goes, oh, do you have a theater degree? And I said, no. And she goes, well, we only tend to hire people with theater degrees. And I said, well, I'll be your first. And I volunteered on that show that fall. And then the next year while teaching history, I helped out at Keller High School on The Wizard of Oz as kind of a tech director there. I just volunteered my time. And then by the next year, I put in for the job and I got hired at Keller High. But the transition was almost immediate. I could tell, like, just I can be creative. I can make this fun. And there's nobody breathing testing scores down my back or like, you know, like my pet peeve was like, we're going to do this in education because these four people aren't doing a good job. Well, go focus on the four people not doing a good job and let your A team do their thing. Like the baseball analogy, I told my principal when I told her I was leaving to go to theater, I said, you're asking the leadoff hitter to hit a home run or you're asking the cleanup hitter to bunt, but it doesn't make any sense. Like, let your players play where they're good and you're going to be more successful.
Yes. So you go from one, at least from a kind of a high school, typical way of thinking, you went from one underappreciated field of endeavor to another. In what ways was teaching theater what you expected it to be? And in what way was it not what you expected it to be?
Wow. The first thing that blew my mind was theater people are messy. They're hoarders. They keep stuff because they always might use it, which I get, trying to save money. But they also just were messy. So the first thing I did was I like cleaned out the ramps going into the theater and put everything away. And I just remember the principal at the time being shocked. He's like, this is great. You've done such a great job. I was like, I just cleaned up stuff. Like, this is once again, most administrators can't tell you what a good theater teacher is, but they're like, it's clean. When there's an assembly, there's a microphone, you know, like, the projector works, like simple things like that. So I kind of realized quickly that I was partially a teacher and director, but I was really more of a systems management guy. How do I get stuff where it can go back where it's supposed to be and kids can get it and put it back and we cannot lose things? Because, I mean, I remember when I was doing Wizard of Oz, I said, hey, I need a tape measure. Go grab me a tape measure. And like 10 minutes went by and a kid came back. And I said, where have you been? He goes, I was waiting on the tape measure. I said, we have one tape measure? Yeah, that's all we have. So I was like, okay. So I went on about like 12 tape measures, but then I made it tough. I was like, guys, the tape measures go here. And you know what we've never had a problem with since? Tape measures.
Nice.
So it's a lot of systems management. That was one thing I noticed that was unexpected. They're goofy. Like, they're incredibly goofy, but they're just like kids. They're just like middle schoolers. They have their different quirks. You know, like I said, like I had the same experience with my eighth period in middle school. I'm like, you know, like you're on deck. You're going to present next. And they're like, what's on deck mean? I'm like, okay, never mind. Okay. And then for a while, it took me forever to stop calling it halftime instead of intermission for the plays. They got on me about that.
Not halftime.
And really the only other thing was kind of politics with like all the debate, all the thought that has to go into in a play. You know, we think theater people in general are really creative, but you really have to be kind of hyperly aware of your community and what there's plays that I think would be appropriate, especially if you cut it a certain way, but I wouldn't even suggest them because I don't think the community would approve that, would like them. And I also don't think I don't want to put any of the people that would have to approve it in a tough spot where they have to stick up for it and then deal backlash themselves. So what I think is appropriate, and I'm not a crazy guy who thinks we should have all sorts of crazy stuff on stage, but there's something I even think it's totally fine on stage that would be that I think every community has different standards on, which is interesting.
It's interesting you brought that up because it was actually one of the questions that I had, and that was, you know, you talk about trying to balance, you know, what the sensibilities of the community is, what the sensibility of administration is, but you also have your students. And, you know, this past year, the district you work in has like a Tony Awards like program for those programs that the different high schools do. And it ran the gamut. I mean, we had Addams Family, we had Winter Wonderland, this is the Bing Crosby. And it seemed to be quite a contrast as far as kind of more of an old fashioned style as opposed to something a little bit more edgy. How do you balance, what is your thought process between what the kiddos would be interested in? Is that even a consideration between and what the community would be interested in?
You know, this is a conversation we have all the time. So we have we're blessed with a very deeply talented bench of kids, right? So when we go to pick a play, particularly let's stick with the musical, the first question is, does it showcase our kids, right? Can we get a lot of kids? We had 89 on stage for Addams Family, I think. Actors only, I think we had 75 at least in Shrek the year before. So you need a play that tends to lead to a big ensemble. So that's the first thing. Does it showcase our kids? Second of all, I mean, obviously, will it get approved? It has to factor in there. But with approval, meaning, will it get approved by the district because of content? And also, will it get approved because we have four high schools in our district? So I'm not going to do Addams Family the same year another school is, or even probably a year after. So you have to kind of figure in how recent has another school nearby done it? And then content, of course, and, you know, what items can be cut, which items can't be. And then really the community is a big thing because putting on a big production can cost $40,000, $50,000. So you have to have one that's going to get people in the door. So we've had the last 3 years have all been pretty successful. We've been building, we had Legally Blonde, Shrek, and then Addams Family. So some pretty popular show titles. And the last two have been really kid friendly. And so a lot of parents love bringing all their children to it. So we'll have 4 year olds and stuff. And we take it to the elementary schools and do a couple songs and dances for them there. But is it family friendly and can we draw a big crowd? It has to be a big factor. So it's tough though, because we start looking at it, it's like, okay, we could do Mean Girl, but not as big of an ensemble, would be popular with our kids, but also not a really family-friendly show. It's just, there's a lot of jokes that'd be tough to cut, and we've looked at cutting it, but it would be such a cut, they wouldn't enjoy doing it anymore. White Christmas was an old school play that Timber Creek did, and it was nice, it was a different style. Mm-hmm. Central did Mary Poppins this year, and that's a classic. I don't ever need to see Mary Poppins again. That's not a dig at them. It's a long old school musical. But you can put a bunch of people in there. So that checks the box. It has some name recognition. Those are the big things. And then can we technically do it? And for example, when we decided to do Addams Family, one of the scenes, Fester goes flying across the stage. And when I did Addams Family 8 years ago, flying four people at the same time cost $7,000. And now flying one person across the stage costs about $12,000. So it's just, that was something we had to say. We would like Fester to fly, but can we do it a different way? Because it's not $12,000 cool to us. I don't know what our sister school did when they did Mary Poppins. And they had Bert has to go and walk on the, you know, he has to fly. I don't know what that costs him, but it's not cheap. So you have to factor that in too. And can we technically get this done?
So can I ask about the scope of these productions? And I've been to some in that school district. Do you tend to, you know, for musicals actually have a pit orchestra, or do you do piped in music or a combination?
That's a really good question. we have four high schools, and it's usually split two and two. Two and two that do live and do not. We typically don't, and there's a couple reasons for that. One, it is expensive and kind of time-consuming to get an orchestra. Two, usually you have to put them in the pit or in the shop or somewhere, but when you have 89 people on stage, you kind of need every square foot of the stage to have people moving and dancing. And then the tracks have just gotten so much better than they used to. We've had people who are music people, and they're like, where's your orchestra at? I'm like, I don't know, around the corner, down the hall in their class. they're just significantly better than they used to be. The tracks are. So that helps. But no, we would love to do it. But another problem we have, and I'm sure other places have the same problem, we have a very successful band and orchestra program at our school, like top in the nation probably, but they're also very busy because of that. So we've spoken with them, and they're like, we would love to do that. Our percussion teacher actually came to us last year. He's like, we really would like to be part of this. And we're like, well, let's have that conversation again next year. But it's usually just hard to get all of them together, that it works with their schedule and ours. So in the 8 years I've been here, I think we've done a live orchestra two times, but we've done tracks the majority of them.
Okay. Well, that was, I don't know if Ross told you, that's kind of my background when I lived in Oregon I really grew up there, but I was attached to a high school theater as their music director. I taught orchestra there, and we kind of had this combination of any kids who were available, but I would also bring in a lot of ringers, you know, who would volunteer their time and play the leads. And so we did some big things, but I know what you mean as far as getting kids to commit, because it's not like just go sit on stage and play. There's a whole rehearsal process, and they need to rehearse with the choir, they need to rehearse on stage and all of that. Real complicated. You know, and if you can do it well, those shows are really difficult. You know, you have to have a top-notch high school music program to even handle a lot of those things.
It's fun. I mean, I love seeing the little pit open. I like seeing the conductor there, and I love it's great for visual gags and cues too, which is nice. But yeah, it's just like, and the other problem is, as you know, the more, if you only want to take off a few of the pit pieces, then you have holes everywhere,
right?
And you got to get drums down there and instruments down there. Also, if it's like, oh, it's like playing Jenga, trying to get your instruments down there. And if anyone has spent time in an orchestra pit, it is not fun. It is dark. It is usually feels damp and musky. I don't like spending any time down there, if we're being honest.
Well, since I want to follow up on just some of the logistics, the idea of miking in musicals, can you speak to that? There are some music directors who are more purists and want them to be able to project to the back of the screen. There are others where everybody has one. Where do you fall in that?
Yeah, so that I get the most comments about mics. So we do not mic any non-musical. So any regular show we mic, that is best practice. You learn to project like right. A normal actor should. It has become more common. I don't know necessarily in my district, but I know a lot of people who mic their people for regular shows. Uh-huh. And it does help the experience, especially for your older crowd that may have hearing issues and whatnot. So there's a value there. But I do think it's slightly detrimental to them long-term, especially from talking to people at the colleges. Now, for the musical, we absolutely mic anyone that has solos. So that has gone from my first year, we would mic 8 people, to now we mic 30 people per show. And microphones are, I don't know if people understand, but microphones are kind of complicated. And the fact that the FCC every so many years will just take away a band of microphones that were totally legal before. And so like you'll go into our school auditorium at the pep rally, the microphone would stop working, but it would work and no one was in there. Well, I'm like, well, that band was sold off. And then when no one's in there, there's no cell phones or anyone to compete with. But when it's full of, you know, 1,000, 1,500 students, you run into issues. And then I, sure enough, you go look at the microphone, like this band has been sold off 6 years ago. it's time to get a new one. And they just don't know. So microphones are frustrating. There we go. But they are being digital now. A lot of them, it's a lot easier to dial in the fine frequencies you need. And then the other issue you run into is being in DFW, where I'm located, there's a lot of traffic on the frequencies between TV, cell phones, everything. So there's now websites that'll help you search the band for clear spots to put your microphones in. But if we didn't have the digital ones we have now, it'd be really hard to get 30 clear microphones that don't interrupt with each other. I remember one year we even were running into frequency problems because the football game was going on and they were on the same frequency we were with their microphones across the parking lot.
Wow.
So it's all sorts of fun. But yes, that is one thing that we have done a really good job, I think, of picking up and acquiring over the years. But then we also hire someone to come in and set up the microphones and run them for the show, because there's nothing more frustrating than putting together a beautiful show and not hearing your actresses or actors. So we think that is the best money you can spend on a musical. If you can do nothing else, let them hear the voices. We can go from there.
I love it.
You know, one of the things about your productions, you know, the two that come to mind is the two recent ones. One was Shrek, which I had a group of German teachers there with me, and they were just blown away at the technical expertise and just the talent that you have at your disposal in the form of actors and singers and what have you. And then with Adam's Family, the same thing, where it seems like it just gets more and more complicated. I'm wondering, to what degree do you think about that? You know, when you're looking at, you kind of broached this real briefly earlier, to what degree do you not want to be the Kidz Bop version of theater musicals, you know, where you're having to cut out half of it or change the lyrics or what have you? How do you, or do you try to tamper down your expectations of what the next production is going to be? Are you trying to top what you did before? Are you just trying to do something interesting as a result?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it goes back to what kids we have. And honestly, a lot of the conversation has to be, how many boys do we have? And then we go from that, right?
Right.
There's some shows, but we it's like, we do not have the boys to pull off that vocally can do it, or even sometimes have the boys in numbers at all that want to act. But I think we'd like to go bigger every year, but then sometimes we look at things we haven't done. So like, Shrek, one of the things that we sit down, we're talking, we're like, okay, what about Shrek? Do we have a Shrek? And we identified two kids that could vocally and physically pull off Shrek. We're like, okay, so we can do that. And then most of the other things we can figure out. But then it was like, we'll look at it technically. And it wasn't a tech heavy show. There was some scenery that had to be moved and some projections and stuff. But it was, you know, we haven't done a show with heavy makeup in years. And that might be a fun challenge for some of our kids that are our makeup kids, you know? So how do we give all those kids a chance to be challenged in the 4 years they're there? So Shrek was a makeup challenge. Adam's Family also was a heavy makeup show. So that was fun in that regard. But years before that, we had pretty basic makeup in Legally Blonde, for example. So how do we challenge the kids in different ways? And then, as we're talking, it's also, yeah, like we had, I mean, the last 2 years, we've pretty much sold out six shows at 750 people per show. And during Shrek, we had somebody making counterfeit tickets and selling them on Craigslist. Like, it was wild. They showed up and they're like, I bought these. I'm like, those aren't even real tickets. And we had to like put disclaimers on them. I get emails from people who don't even work at our school, because we give every teacher two free tickets, saying like, are your tickets available yet? And I'm like, I promise I will send it out as soon as we release the tickets. We let our boosters buy first, and then you can get your free tickets. How do we updo last year? What can we do different? What can we do different? What can we keep wowing people with? I think we're all trying to do it to a point, but not in an inflammatory way, but like just in a, wow, that feels like a really good experience going to the theater. I want to do that when I get older. I think that's the best marketing we can do to get more kids into fine arts is let them experience theater. And that's why we, like Miss Tapia, who I work with, she's great. And she has really taken a big effort of taking Adams and Shrek to the elementary schools and like letting them meet the characters. And, you know, we hear about that. I have kids right now that were in Wizard of Oz as a munchkin. When we did Wizard of Oz, we had elementary school kids, and they're like, oh, I was a munchkin. And I'm like, oh, my son was a munchkin. And, oh, there's a picture of the two of you next to each other. And but that was their first theatrical experience. And like, that was the first time I was on this stage, which is kind of fun.
For someone who doesn't really know much about the theater world, especially at the high school level, what would you say is perhaps the biggest service that y'all provide for the students who are involved beyond the immediate experience of knowing how to put it on a production, knowing how to do makeup or create a set or move sets about or what have you? What do you, you know, because we talked about a lot, you know, because Steve was also a tennis coach, and we talked about, you know, how athletes benefit from being on a field or on a court. Where do you see the advantages for students being a part of a theater program that you witnessed over these last years?
Particular, probably fine arts in general, for the most part. I think there's a lot of critical thinking and analysis that goes in. Hey, we need to build this. How do we build this? Or your character just lost their daughter. Like, their daughter has been taken from them. If you were a mother, or what would your mother do if someone took you and they were behind a wall and they couldn't open the door? I don't know, she'd keep knocking. No, she wouldn't. Your mom would tear down the door. Your mom would take apart the building brick by brick. She'd go through the window. So there's some critical thinking and analysis that goes there. There's a lot of times I'm like, hey, we're gonna build it this way. And the kid's like, one of the kids would be like, you know, we could just build it this way, do the same thing, and be a lot easier. And I'm like, yes, it would. Thank you. And we'll do it that way. I think there is a lot of more cultural appreciation. I think they're exposed to different groups of people, different. I mean, obviously, we have a very diverse group of people, and you don't have to necessarily like all their choices, but at least you're like, okay, they're good people still. They may wear something different than I would, or they may look different, or they may do other things. And even in reverse of my experience teaching eighth period in middle school and liking the non-athletic kids, I actually really enjoy my technical theater one class, which I call a bunch of bros, because it's fun seeing them, especially when they get excited and they also realize, oh, these kids aren't all weird. They're kind of fun. I enjoy what they do. And like, we did a play about baseball a couple years ago, and the baseball boys came to the play, which was fun. And then a bunch of the theater kids, we went to a baseball game, which was also cool seeing them try to do that spring. And then I think just a lot of soft skills. I think handshaking, eye contact, being able to hold a conversation, a lot of times are skills they develop a lot more in fine arts than other places, because they're up and moving, they're meeting people, they're, hey, we got this guy in who's doing the sound, I want you to introduce yourself to him, and they get to learn from people, experts in their fields, which is nice. So I think those are some of the big things. Self-expression, you know, trusting their artistic instincts on choices they want to make. I don't know if that answers the question, but yeah, I think those are some of the big ones.
I've been studying the idea of grit, particularly in athletics, but also in the arts, you know, and what the coaches or directors have to offer, and that is very different than in a classroom, because there's a closeness, there's a shared goal, and invariably, and I've probably done 20 or 30 plays, musicals over the years, there's always almost this honeymoon period, then there's a low point that people have to fight through. It's a little bit cliche, but it always happens, and then it becomes the student's play, and they move forward. Can you talk about that? Because I know I'm not imagining it.
No. So you're talking about like the start of a production, going through all the work, and then them taking kind of ownership and becoming their thing? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
there?
But there's also kind of a crisis a little bit, and there's social relationships and wondering, can we even pull this off? And then everyone does.
Yeah. And yes, definitely. So the musical is probably the best example of that, because we will cast it in May. We'll start rehearsals in August, and it goes up end of October, early November.
Wow.
And it's a time commitment, right? And like I said, we had 89 people, and a lot of them kids that we had, like one girl was in my tech class, I love her to death. And she's like, I'm going to do tech. She also does tennis. But then she's like, oh, Adam's Family, I think I want to be in that. I was like, oh, you definitely should. But her fall, I mean, you can imagine doing tennis every morning, being a junior, having all that homework, and then having rehearsal till 6:30 at night, and then repeat plus Saturday rehearsals here and there. It's a big commitment. So like, yeah, there's this excitement at the beginning, and then there's the, we're learning the dances, which is fun, but then there's the tedious, you know, we also have a play going on during that. Plus the band needs a stage and the orchestra needs a stage and there's an assembly. So a lot of times we're rehearsing in the cafeteria, the library, the orchestra hall, the hallway. So yeah, then there's the point of everyone's tired. Everyone's starting to get cranky with each other, you know, and I always tell them, I'm like, look, when you go home tonight, hug your mother and tell her you love her, because there's no doubt that right now you've been home very little. So she misses you. Your grades are probably not as good as you want them to be. And you're stressed at your mom. So just go home tonight and just tell your mother you love her and give her a big hug. So then going into probably 2 weeks before the musical, 3 weeks before the musical, everyone's super stressed, cranky at each other. There's probably one or two showmances going on of people dating now, and that's causing all sorts of drama. And then by the time the week before dress rehearsal is usually the worst, in my opinion, then dress rehearsal started on like, you know, Monday, and then the show opens Thursday, and then you're just too tired to know any better. But by the time you get that first opening night, it's this wave of excitement and it was all worth it. And then we'll finish up 2 weekends of the show and we'll get community members and actors that are like, can we do another weekend? And it's like, no, we are done. We are moving on. There's a band concert in here tomorrow. We got to clear the stage. You need to go home and take a nap. I'm tired. My wife forgot what I look like. Everyone needs to go home. And, you know, and so it is funny seeing the ebb and flow of all the emotion and the exhaustion. And it's just like, I mean, marching band, I imagine, would be the exact same thing. It's like we've been marching out in 100-degree heat for 3 months and we just went third overall in the state. Now we're all happy, and now we're sad it's over. So
yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, these are things and emotions that you don't typically get as a classroom teacher. If you think back to that time, it's very different.
Yeah, the connection is different, right? I mean, just the amount of hours you spend with them. My drama teacher in high school, my mom always said, Lana Olson spent more time with you during the school year than I did. And I think Lana thinks, my friends with Lana on Facebook, she's my theater teacher. And every so often, a bunch of us will get together and have dinner or something. And we'll take a picture and say, the Lana Olson fan club. And she's like, that's so sweet. You guys remember me. It's like, no, literally, you were instrumental in our lives. And we appreciate that you brought us all together. And I know you didn't always like us. In fact, I didn't like me half the time. So I can't imagine you dealing with me doing stupid things. And the funny thing is, the things that I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. That's exactly what kids do today. And I'm like, oh no, I was you.
Well, there's so many different directions that we could take this, and it's evident, it's clear that we have a lot more to talk about if you're interested in coming back on with us. So we might maybe kind of want to wrap up this current train of thought and then, you know, maybe hint at what else we could talk about as we close out. But, you know, I've had a lot of your students in my class, you know, and it's fun to watch them go through, you know, they're dragging, you know, especially those first period kiddos, 8:30 comes pretty early. One of the things I remember when I was, you know, studying, you know, talk about what you do with your time after the deed is done, after the degree has been completed or after the show has been done. How do you process that? And do you ever try to walk your kids through it? Or is it something that everyone has to kind of figure out their own way to decompress after a show is completed?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. They kind of walk around like zombies after that. And it's like, they're like in a trance, like, what am I supposed to do today? So it's good in that regard. Yeah, I mean, usually by the end, it's, like I said, it just comes down so fast. You close on Sunday, and by Monday, you know, a two-story set is taken down, and the costumes are put on a rack and set back, and the theater returns back to its natural state of empty, and there's a concert on stage the next day. And it's just like, it is kind of weird. Like, I feel like it took us a month to build this, and we're taking it down in one day. And I'm like, yes, if you want to build monuments and houses, this is not the job for you. They don't like us. And it's frustrating because, like, I worked really hard on that. I go, I know. And it looked really good for those 2 weeks, you know? So there's a little bit of that. I mean, we just did a big design project. The state of Texas does a theatrical design contest. So this year the theme was Hadestown. And they had to, like, take the play and set it in a different time period and base it on whatever theme they think Hadestown is about, which is a very design-heavy project. And design's not my favorite thing, but it's an important part. So a lot of kids don't care for it all that much, but I like to think that they learn stuff from it. But at the end of this month-long process where they could pick whichever category, I was like, look, I really tried to make it where all the minutia of, like, what size board you needed to mount it on and giving you a printer and printing labels for you, I did, so that you were focused on the design portion of it. Like, what could I do better to help it where it's a more smooth process for you? And of course, the answer is always like, well, we'd like more time. And I'm like, well, if I give you 2 months, would there be any difference of actual quality, or would it just be more time to work on it? And I, oh, that's true too. So I try to get feedback on that. And usually the best feedback is we get is, you know, how many kids are wanting to do it next year. And my favorite thing to see is usually we film every musical that we can, and then you go to every grad party, and the musical is just playing in the background of the grad party. Right. And it's like, okay, obviously they enjoyed it, and that's like, I'm like, because you're never going to watch it for fun. Musicals being recorded suck. The quality is never what you want. The camera's not close enough. But I'm like, it's always a good background graduation party video, you know. So I think that's some of the best feedback we get. But I mean, the kids always have suggestions of what plays we can do. But I'm like, we're not going to do Rent, guys. A school in New York did Rent, but instead of having AIDS, the characters had diabetes. And then they got sued by the producers because you can't do that. And they're like, we can do that. Like, no, we cannot.
Diabetes just don't punch as hard as, I guess, other things. But it's fascinating to talk with you. And, I think about, as a history teacher, you know, we're always reading. And so, especially during the summer, we're always picking up ideas. And part of me thinks that you're always watching films or watching TV shows just in the course of your own interest. And you think, we could do that. Maybe that's possible. And perhaps that could be a discussion for the next time, as well as just talking a little bit about some of the challenges that fine arts face in the face of, you know, an emphasis on STEM, you know, mm-hmm. even though STEAM is now, they threw us a bone and added the A, you know, so, but as far as the kind of challenges that, you know, theater folks and the fine arts in general face and deal with and have to navigate as part of their focus. But I'm so grateful that you came on, just because I just think you're so interesting to hear, you know, talk to and break down all the things that you've been doing. And so with that, I guess we can kind of wrap things up here, Dr. Bourgeois, for now. Perhaps future episodes to come. Brian, I thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. I know you love what you did with, you know, teaching, and I love teaching. I feel very supported. I have a great team. I just want to make sure that's clear. Like, there's no way any one person can run a 6-day theater. I'm part of a team. We are incredibly well supported and whatnot in our district, from the top down, from our campus principal up. A lot of places aren't as lucky as we are, and I don't ever forget that. But I think fine arts is an interesting place right now across the state, across the country, and I think it'll be a struggle going forward for a little bit as we continue to face some budget deficits and tough decisions have to be made. But I think it's a conversation for another time. But I appreciate you guys having me on, and love to join again. And wonderful meeting you, Steve. And Ross, always good to see you. So
it's been a pleasure. And I guess the next thing that I'm going to do in about 10 minutes, this, and I'm not making this up, my daughter and I are going to get some tacos and go back to the house. And for about the third time together, we're going to watch the Broadway version of Into the Woods with Bernadette Peters. And I've watched it many times, and that we're going to watch it again from start to finish. And it's something we do. So good timing on that one.
Good. That sounds like a fun night or a good afternoon. So
absolutely.
And I am about to watch preseason baseball, Orioles versus Red Sox. So I will take the lower road.
Yes, you will. It's not even the regular season yet, and there you go.
Listen, I've been chomping at the bit for this. So I mean, I need this in my life. So, in keeping with the theme, so long, farewell, auf Wiedersehen, goodbye.
Oh my!
Mr. Ketchum, Herr Dr. Bourgeois.
Auf Wiedersehen. Thank you all. Thanks, Brian. I enjoyed it. Great meeting you.
Yeah.
All right. Bye.